Frank Muir goes into lust and investigates the humor of the subject with the help of Alfred Marx.
I had a job once at the YWCA, you know, maintenance. Had to check all the central heating was working in all the girls' bedrooms, you know. £7 a week. I know it's not much, but it was all I could afford. The bride and groom were finally alone. The groom said, "May I kiss you, darling?" "Oh, gorge," he said, "another amateur." During the Middle Ages, two beautiful young maidens and their ugly old nurse were cowering in an upstairs room of a castle while hordes of barbarians laid siege to it. Eventually, the barbarians broke into the castle and ran around screaming with delight, looting and pillaging. A group of them burst down the door of the girls' room and stood there looking at them lasciviously. It was the moment for a noble action. The elder girl came forward. "Do what you like to me and my sister," she said, "but I beg you, do not touch our aged nurse." The nurse said, "Mind your own business. War is war." An interviewer going round an old people's home, talking to the inmates. He goes up to one quite old gentleman.
How old are you, sir?
97.
Uh-huh. And to what do you attribute your great age?
I've never smoked, never drunk, and never had nothing to do with women.
Nothing to do with women.
Right.
Thank you. You over there, sir. May I have a word? Mm. How old are you, sir?
101.
No.
Yes.
No.
Yes, you said yes.
101. And to what do you attribute your great age?
I've never had anything to do with women.
I've never had anything to... Time for one more, I think, before tea. Ah, there's a dear, grey-haired, wizened gentleman... Tell me, sir, what do you attribute your age to?
Women. Huh? Women. Lust. What? Lots and lots of women. All them women.
But women.
Women. That's what I put it down to.
Sir,
yes.
How old are you?
I'll be 23 next birthday.
A vicar was preaching the sermon on the Ten Commandments, and when he came to "Thou shalt not steal," he noticed that a meek-looking man in the front row suddenly looked very uncomfortable. The vicar was puzzled, but continued, and when he reached "Thou shalt not commit adultery," the meek-looking man looked suddenly relieved. Afterwards, the vicar was talking to the man and mentioned his strange reactions.
"Well, you see," said the man, "when you said thou shalt not steal, I thought someone would take my umbrella. But when you got to thou shalt not commit adultery, I remembered where I'd left it."
Lust. Lust is one of the seven deadly sins, and also part of one of the world's greatest pleasures. As a result, attitudes to it are always a bit ambivalent, and perhaps this is why it features so universally in humour. Stories of lust and its attempted gratification are part of comedy in all fields, from the sophistication of restoration comedy to the boldness of dirty jokes. And it seems that lust does occupy a lot of people's thinking time, says Malcolm Muggeridge.
It has to be admitted that we English have sex on the brain, but it's a very unfortunate place to have
And if you've got it on the brain, it can take up quite a lot of your life. Here's a remark from Mrs. Alfred Kinsey, wife of the famous researcher into sexual matters.
I don't see so much of Alfred anymore since he got so interested in sex.
Perhaps now we should have a quick definition just to clarify our terms of reference. From Clifford Odets.
Sex, the poor man's polo.
Not without its disadvantages. Blame for all kinds of trouble has been laid at the door of lust. Robert Burton from his Anatomy of Melancholy.
Thunder and lightning, wars, fires, plagues have not done that mischief to mankind as this burning lust.
And yet existence would be pretty dull without it. Dr. Johnson on the subject.
Some desire is necessary to keep life in motion.
That's a state of affairs that seems likely to continue for some time. Lust will continue to take up more than its fair share of people's thoughts, and boy will go on meeting girl.
I meet a girl at my European analyst's. I have to explain this. I was going to a European analyst, and that meant the European boy could see my analyst for 6 months, you know? A neurotic exchange program. And I invite her up to my hotel. I was staying at the George V in Paris. And I get all ready for our dinner date. You know, I anoint myself completely. And I beat my body with olive branches. You know? I throw an amber light on me to make me look really effective. Two little backlights to give me the illusion of three dimensions. You know? And a baby spot to pick out the brown in my eyes. And I put on my mood music records, you know, my Arthur Godfrey Hawaiian music. She had invited me over to her place, but I didn't want to lug the lights and everything, you know, so. And my radiator breaks and the hotel room is absolutely freezing. And I'm ashamed, you know, because she's going to come into a cold room. So I go into the bathroom and I turn on the hot water in the shower, which is an old Brooklyn trick to heat the apartment. And hot water comes down and billows of steam come into the living room. And ice cold air is seeping in under the windowsill. And the two fronts meet in the living room. And it starts to rain in my hotel room. Standing there in the rain, and I did not do well with the girl. Europe for me, as a matter of fact, was a series of near misses. I was at a cast party with our cast, and I was in the corner, and I was playing the vibes, very sexy, like a jazz musician, really up and down. And a great girl comes up behind me, but really elaborate, and she says to me, "You play vibes?" I say, "Yeah. It helps me sublimate my sexual tensions." She says, "Why don't you let me help you sublimate your sexual tensions?" So I figure, great, you know, here's a girl who plays vibes. I turn quickly and ask her out for a date, but Peter O'Toole, who's in the movie, asks her out first, aces me out, you know, and she was a beautiful girl, so I said to her, "Could you bring a sister for me?" And she did. Sister Maria Theresa.
Woody Allen, who else? Lust is, according to tradition, at its strongest in young people. I don't know whether or not that's true. It's probably just that as people grow older, they accept it more. Don't spend so much time talking about it. Obviously, when you are young, the facts of life are new and interesting. A report from the Sunday Express.
Edinburgh's Director of Education, referring to sex education, is reported to have said, "Teachers noticed a new look in children's eyes after an experimental course."
Yeah, it's an old look, actually. In some cases, children seem to know everything without instruction. Here's a letter from the Daily Mirror.
"Why all this fuss about sex education in schools? I'm 16 and I taught my mother about reproduction using the correct biological terms. The present generation of parents cannot tell their children how they came to be born because they do not know."
I sort of managed. It's a parent's duty to keep a watchful eye over the morals of their offspring and to keep a balance between restraint and freedom. A difficult task, as this report from the Birmingham Post reveals.
The mother complained that her son, an only child, was becoming truculent, had started smoking, had been seen entering a public house and was keeping company with a girl. Inspector McCann began to investigate. He reported, "Oh, I found that the son was 36.
That's probably taking restraint a bit far, but it can't be easy for a father if his child, if his only son, wants to go on holiday with a member of the opposite sex. The glums.
"What I really had in mind was, well, somewhere really exotic. Somewhere on the continent."
"Oh, the continent, as they call it, eh? Ooh, ooh la la, vive le sport."
"It's not all that expensive, you see. Mabel Allwright passed on to me the brochure of the place she and her Reg went last year. Oh. It's called Les Zoutes."
"Les Zoutes? Les zoot. Oh, yes, that's South France, isn't it? Yes, near Marseillaise.
No, Mr. Glum, it's North Belgium.
Oh, yes, yes, that's right. Yes, you're quite right. Yes, I was thinking of before the war, yes. Belgium, eh? Where all the Belgians live, eh? Show us that brochure. Let's have a voici, as they say over there.
Oh, it looks gorgeous, doesn't it? See, Ron?
Yes, eh? All the bays and coves and little rocky bits.
Oh, we could have 9 days there on the money.
Oh, it does look nice. I would still have preferred the south of France, but, well, it is your treat, eh? So I'll go wherever you want.
Mr. Glamour, I think you've got the wrong end of the stick. The idea was just Ron and me.
Eh?
Alone.
Ethel? I don't think I'm with you.
We don't want you with us.
That's enough from you, my boy. One more word like that and I'll deprive you of your chewing gum. Now then. Hey, I'm speaking to you now. Is it your idea that you and Ron, an unmarried engaged couple, should go off alone together for 9 days under the hot North Belgium sun?
Yes, Mr. Glum.
Hello. Hello, hello, hello.
Hello, Dad.
Glum, I hope you're not going to be old-fashioned, but lots of things have changed since your day.
And some things have stayed the same. I'm very sorry, Ethel. I won't entertain it.
Look, Mr. Glum.
No?
Well, Ron and I have been engaged nearly 7 years.
I know.
We've never been alone together for long enough to really get to know each other.
Perhaps that's for the best, eh?
Alone, Mr. Glum. On our own, in a place like Les Zoot, we can at last make those mutual discoveries every young couple should make.
All the bays and coves and little rocky bits.
I'm very sorry indeed to have to say this, eh? I'm very sorry. You two are not carting off to the continent unchaperoned. If me and Mrs. Glum can't come with you, you can forget the whole idea.
But you can't come with us. Oh, the money doesn't run to four. You can see what the all-in price is, £14 per each.
All right.
And my windfall's only £42 in all.
All right.
Oh, Ron, you talk to him.
All right, Ed. Look, Dad, if Ethel wants to take me on holiday, why can't I be taken? Don't you trust me?
Well, if you want to know, Ron, no, I don't.
Well, suppose I give my word. I promise I will not stay in the water too long.
Jimmy Edwards, Dick Bentley and June Whitfield. Anxiety over people's sexual behaviour can develop into prudery, which is often more of a comment on the person shocked than on what they find shocking. The Victorians were very strict in matters of decorum. Here's an extract from a book of etiquette by Lady Gough, published in 1863.
The perfect hostess will see to it that the works of male and female authors be properly separated on her bookshelves. Their proximity, unless they happen to be married, should not be tolerated.
Really suspicious, mind. The prudes, on the whole, are suspicious. Maria Edgeworth, writing in 1814.
I hate scandal. At least I'm not so fond of it as the lady of whom it was said she could not see the poker and tongs standing together without suspecting something wrong.
Another approach to the whole business, if you disapprove of it, is just to pretend it doesn't exist and hope it'll go away. From Our Church Review.
At both services in the morning, it is intended to preach a series of sermons on the deadly sins, omitting lust.
If lust remains, in spite of being ignored, then perhaps a system of rationing should be brought in. This was recommended by Andrew Board in about 1542 in his Compendious Regiment, or A Dietary of Health.
Beware of venereous acts before the first sleep. And especially beware of such things after dinner or after a full stomach, for it doth engender the cramp and the gout and other displeasures.
You have been warned. Board also had what he reckoned was a foolproof cure for lust, which would take your mind off it completely. All a gentleman has to do is...
to leap into a great vessel of cold water, or to put nettles in the codpiece.
There's another sort of sense to brief encounter, isn't it? After that experience, it's quite possible that you'd restrict your lust simply to a spectator sport.
Some men, they like a game of dummies. Some men, they like to do the pools. Some men, they like to be never out on a strike. Some, they're always down in tools. Some men, they like a carton in the park. Some try to do it on the prom. But me, every night, I'm out till early light. 'Cause I like to be a peeping Tom. Now it be you ladies' turn now. Some girls they like a lot of loving. Some girls take better fast. Some girls they like taking booty care at night. Some they let nature take its course. Some girls they like undressing in the dark. Some they like to leave the lighties on. That's when I comes by with me beady little eye. I likes to be a peeping Tom. Cheerio!
That was Roy Hudd. Some people have answered the problem of lust by criticizing the system and wishing that the whole sexual function could be changed. Here's a suggestion from, of all people, Martin Luther.
The reproduction of mankind is a great marvel and mystery. Had God consulted me in the matter, I should have advised him to continue the generation of the species by fashioning them of clay.
Unfortunately for Luther, and possibly fortunately for us, God never asked his advice. But Sir Thomas Browne put forward an interesting suggestion in the 17th century.
I could wish that we might procreate like trees without conjunction, or that there were any way to perpetuate the word without this trivial and vulgar way of coition. It is the foolishest act a wise man commits in his whole life, nor is there anything that will deject his cold imagination more when he shall consider what an odd and unworthy piece of folly he hath committed. I speak not in prejudice, nor am averse from that sweet sex, but naturally amorous of all that is beautiful. I can look a whole day with delight upon a handsome picture, though it be but of a horse.
Everyone to his own taste, I don't. Most people, fortunately, can reconcile themselves to the existence of lust. One disadvantage, though, is that it is a distraction. News from the Daily Mail.
When I first glimpsed the backs of women's knees, I seemed to hear the first movement of Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony.
Here's an anonymous 18th century poem.
We're all dry with a drink of it. We're all dry with a drink of it. The minister kissed the fiddler's wife. I couldn't have preached for thinking of it.
Lust does make concentration difficult. If you want to, of course, you can actually stimulate it and make concentration, therefore, even more difficult. Here's a report from the Daily Mirror.
Mr. Joseph Murat, owner of the Gallipoli restaurant in Bishopsgate City, explained, I have discovered that city gentlemen with their wives have different views about how near a belly dancer may dance. I have instructed the 11 dancers, 5 men and 6 women, how to behave. If there is a titled dignitary in the room, they dance only on the stage. If there are city sheriffs, aldermen and councillors, they may dance within 4 feet. Bankers may be approached at 2 feet and insurance executives at 1 foot.
The trouble with lust is that though there's nothing all that wrong with it in itself, it can lead to immorality. But not always, as this misprinted advertisement from the Liverpool Echoes shows.
Going overseas, emigration, business, or lust pleasure. Immediate passages available.
Ah, yes, sin, you see. That's where lust can lead. It leads to sin. Particularly when the sun comes out, according to Lord Byron.
What men call gallantry and God's adultery is much more common where the climate's sultry.
Adultery can also lead to divorce and all sorts of problems. But not, it seems, during the last war. A report from a wartime Reynolds News.
West End solicitors who before the war netted five-figure incomes from divorce cases have been heavily hit by the blackout. In the winter months, at any rate, private inquiry agents are helpless. Adultery cannot be proved because identification is impossible in the pitch dark.
Sometimes one feels the whole business of lust must have been simpler in less sophisticated times. Here's an unintentional comment due to misspelling in a schoolboy's examination answer.
The early Britons made their houses of mud and there was rough mating on the floors.
Beautifully simple. Or perhaps the answer is to put lust right behind you in sexual matters and to concentrate on more practical considerations of life. Here's a small ad from the Lincolnshire Chronicle.
Owner of tractor on HP wishes to correspond with widow who owns a modern Foster thrasher. Object matrimony. Send photograph of machine.
I should have thought the object was to thrash Foster. Here's another from the Grantham Journal.
Miss Gibbon of Ketton has no male goat this season and refers all clients to Mr. Clifton.
He's a little fellow with a beard. You can possibly an older man, too. There's a particular sort of lust reserved for older men and often directed towards young girls.
She was young, she was pure, she was new, she was nice. She was fair, she was sweet, 17. He was old, he was vile, and no stranger to vice. He was base, he was bad, he was mean. He had slyly inveigled her up to his flat to view his collection of stamps. All unperforated. And he said as he hastened to put out the cat, the wine, his cigar and the lamps, have some Madeira, me dear. You really have nothing to fear. I'm not trying to tempt you, that wouldn't be right. You shouldn't drink spirits at this time of night. Have some Madeira, me dear. It's very much nicer than beer. I don't care for sherry, one cannot drink stout, and port is a wine I can well do without. It's simply a case of shaken arse on gout. Have some Madeira. Unaware of the wiles of the snake in the grass, of the fate of the maiden who topes, she lowered her standards by raising her glass, her courage, her eyes, and his hopes. She sipped it, she drank it, she drained it, she did. He quietly refilled it again. And he said as he secretly carved one more notch on the butt of his gold-handled cane, have some Madeira, me dear. I've got a small cask of it here. And once it's been opened, you know it won't keep. Do finish it up, it will help you to sleep. Have some Madeira, me dear. It's really an excellent year. Now, if it were gin, you'd be wrong to say yes. The evil gin does would be hard to assess. Besides, it's inclined to affect me prowess. So have some Madeira, me dear. Then there flashed through her mind what her mother had said with her antepenultimate breath. Oh, my child, should you look on the wine when 'tis red, be prepared for a fate worse than death. She let go her glass with a shrill little cry. Ah! Crash, tinkle, it fell to the floor. When he asked what in heaven, she made no reply, up her mind and a dash for the door. Have some, but you're off, me dear, rang out down the hall loud and clear. A tremulous cry that was filled with despair as she paused to take breath in the cool midnight air. Have some, Madiara, Midia. The words seemed to ring in her ear. Until the next morning, she woke up in bed with a smile on her lips and an ache in her head. And a beard in her ear hole that tickled and said, have some, Madiara, Midia.
Michael Flanders and Donald Swan. Let's close with a few lines by Robert Burns.
The cared prevailed, the unblushing fair in his embrace is sunk. Partly with love or come cessair, and partly she was drunk.
Well, that's it. We've come to the end of our last programme. From me and Alfred Marx, it's goodbye.
Goodbye.
Muir Goes Into Lust was produced by Simon Brett and John Lloyd.